This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll hear Terry's interview with Gretchen Reynolds, whose book called The First 20 Minutes examines new research that reveals ways we can exercise better, train smarter, and live longer. But first, Lena Dunham. She's the 25-year-old creator, writer, and star of the HBO series Girls. Lena Dunham first received national recognition for her 2010 independent film Tiny Furniture. Judd Apatow liked that film and is now the executive producer of Girls. The storylines of both Tiny Furniture and Girls are loosely based on Dunham's own experiences as a recent college graduate in New York City. In Girls, Dunham plays a young woman named Hannah, who's in a transitory period. She's an aspiring writer living with her best friend in a small Brooklyn apartment. When the series starts, she's working as an unpaid intern at a publishing company. Here's the opening scene of the pilot episode. Dunham's character Hannah is out to dinner with her parents, who are visiting from out of town. They're played by Becky Ann Baker and Peter Scolari.
Hannah, your mother and I have been talking, and we feel that it may be time. How can I phrase this? Well, we see how well you're doing at work, and you really seem to be figuring out what it is that you want. But it may be time for one final push.
What is a final push?
We're not going to be supporting you any longer.
See, I wasn't going to phrase it like that, Lorraine, the way you phrased it.
But I have no job.
No, you have an internship that you say is going to turn into a job.
I don't know when.
You graduated from college 2 years ago. We've been supporting you for 2 years, and that's enough.
Do you know how crazy the economy is right now? I mean, all my friends get help from their parents.
We are sympathetic to that.
But I'm your only child. It's not like I'm draining all your resources. I mean, this feels very arbitrary.
You don't know anything about our finances. I mean, we're professors, Hannah, professors. You know, we can't keep bankrolling your groovy lifestyle.
My groovy lifestyle?
The bills add up. We're covering your rent, your insurance, your cell phone.
You said it was cheaper for you if I was on the family plan.
Yeah.
May I get you more of anything?
No, she's fine.
Well, that's a scene from the first episode of Girls. Lena Dunham, welcome back to Fresh Air. I can't believe how much has happened to you since last we spoke. When we last spoke, Girls was in the works. You didn't know if HBO would accept it. Now it's just like, outside of Mad Men, probably the most talked about series. And, you know, like your character gets off to such a kind of almost unlikable start. You know, she sounds so entitled, like, no, you're my parents. You owe it to me to support me.
You feel like the next words out of her mouth are going to be, I didn't ask to be born. She doesn't say it, but it's implied.
There's this sense of entitlement. And also the sense that she wants to be treated as a child, but she also wants to be treated as an adult.
Yeah, which I think is such a marker of this age. I mean, it's so funny. I am, you know, a working woman out in the world, but I still live with my parents half the time. I've been sort of taking this very long, stuttering period of moving out. And so I really relate to that feeling because I feel like I'm constantly asking them to please stay out of my work life, but also please bring me soup. Like, it's this weird moment where you just don't have a sense of what age-appropriate behavior is because there sort of is no such thing as age-appropriate behavior.
And it must be difficult for you in a way because you wrote the series and conceived of it and star in it, people assume, well, Hannah is really just Lena Dunham. And therefore, Lena Dunham is spoiled.
I'm sure that I've had some really unattractive spoiled moments in my years, but I've never, that conversation that Hannah had has never happened to me, in large part because when I graduated from college, my parents let me live with them, but they made it really clear that they weren't going to support any of my endeavors. They were like, you can live with us, and that's a great gift we can give you, but you've got to have a job. You have to figure out, just like we did, how to make a creative life, and we're giving you a great step ahead by already living in the city that you want to be in, but we're not going to serve that function for you. Our parents didn't do it for us, and we don't think it's healthy.
I was just making me think about how almost treacherous it must be to be so out there when you're still in a fairly formative phase, you know, when you're in the early days of independent adulthood and you're putting your life out there on the screen in a transformed fictional way, but you're drawing on your own experiences and you're turning them into negative experiences for dramatic purposes for your character. So it really must be transformational for you to be going through this now, since the early 20s are a transformational period for most people one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. My dad is a painter and he teaches graduate school. And one of the things that he always says is he thinks students should wait until after graduate school to show their work, because he thinks it's important to have that moment where you kind of are experimenting without the feeling of someone's gaze on you, or without the feeling that you're sort of going to be held to the decisions that you make in your creative process throughout your life. But the thing is, I come from a very different generation than my father. You know, bad poetry I wrote in high school can still be found on the internet. And, you know, there's a web log of our college newspaper. You know, there's so many different stages of my creative development are sort of on record if somebody were to choose to look for them. And so I've sort of just made the decision to be okay with the fact that I'm not going to love everything that I put out into the world. And I kind of go, well, maybe my hope is, oh, maybe it'll sometime be helpful for another young artist to sort of see my development and see the way that I sort of lived out loud a little bit. But there's definitely times where I don't think I let the sort of the weight of it hit me, the amount of stuff about my own life, the amount of images of my own body that I've put out into the world. And then I also love what I do, and no one has forced me to do it. But there's the occasional moment at like 3 a.m. where I suddenly realize, like, my breasts are on TV, as is a fairly accurate account of my first post-college relationship. And you have your like 5 minutes of existential terror before you return to sleep about that topic.
So I want to play another scene from Girls. And this is a scene where your character, Hannah, is going to her boyfriend to break up with him because he texted her a picture of his privates, and then texted, "This what wasn't meant for you." And she thinks, "Well, like, who wasn't meant for? And like, what's going on here? Is there another girl?" And so you show up unannounced at his door to break up with him. And in this scene, you're explaining to him who you are and what kind of girl you are.
Yeah, I've never asked you for anything. I don't even want anything. Okay. I respect your right to see and do whoever you want, and I don't even want a boyfriend, so.
What do you want?
I just want someone who wants to hang out all the time and thinks I'm the best person in the world and wants to have sex with only me. And it makes me feel very stupid to tell you this, because it makes me sound like a girl who wants to, like, go to brunch. And I really don't want to go to brunch, and I don't want you to, like, sit on the couch while I shop or, like, even meet my friends. I don't even want that.
I think that's really an interesting description of how she's defining herself as a girl. Why was it important for your character to get that out?
Well, I think that there's a way that Hannah, and by extension myself, she has trouble with certain kinds of earnest expressions. And maybe that's a generational thing. Maybe that's her own anxiety that if she expresses herself in a true way, she's going to get shut down. But I think it was important for her, even as she said this incredibly sort of sweet, heartfelt thing, which is, I want you to want to spend time with just me. I want you to want to be with me. I mean, she wants what everybody wants, which is,
she wants a monogamous boyfriend.
A monogamous loving partner. And yet she feels like she needs to explain that while she wants the thing everybody else wants, she is not like everybody else. And I think that is the important distinction to her, is that she thinks with the desire for a boyfriend comes all of these other trappings of being a sort of like bougie woman that she doesn't think of herself as. She's like, I'm a writer and a thinker. And so anything you equate with being a boyfriend is not what you're going to get with me, even though once they were together, she probably would want him to meet her friends. She probably would want him to sit on the couch while they shopped. And God forbid she would want him to go to brunch. But in this moment, she sort of needs to define herself as this completely other type of woman, even as she wants what women want.
But is your character trying to say, I'm not the person you're going to see in chick lit or, you know, chick films, or you know what I'm saying?
Definitely. I think she definitely is. I mean,
And do you feel that way? Do you feel like I don't relate to a certain kind of character that I see in literature or that I see in movies?
I do feel that way. It's funny because romantic comedy, when done right, is my favorite genre. You know, it's just a genre that's very human. But I think, you know, the sort of anything that has not any, Bridesmaids had a pink poster and I loved it, but I don't want to call out any movie specifically, but there is a certain kind of film that isn't even fun to me in a guilty pleasure way. And there's a certain kind of chick lit book that isn't even fun to me in a guilty pleasure way, because I don't see any of myself in it, because none of my just none of my actions, maybe this is speaking to my age, which is 25, but I don't think this is the case. None of my actions have ever sort of been motored by the search for a husband or wondering if I was going to have a family someday or wanting to live in a really great house or thinking it would be really great to have a diamond. Like, there's just certain drives. And I know that maybe those things are representative of, like, a bigger desire for love or something else. I'm sure that those writers would not appreciate me distilling their thesis down to the search for a diamond. But there's a kind of female character that doesn't make sense to me.
So
if that makes sense to you.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think women in particular are so hungry for a series or a movie or movies about young women who are, you know, kind of feminist, whether they describe themselves that way or not, and aren't just all about clothes and engagement rings, and who are trying to just, like, really figure out who they are and where they fit in the world. And
yeah.
And because your series is trying to do that, it's gotten so much attention from the press and through tweets and blogs because you're trying so hard to represent young women or a certain kind of young woman. So it's gotten a lot of praise for that, but it's also gotten criticism by people think, but it's not about me. You're saying it's girls, but I don't see myself in it. And I think that's been particularly true of people of color who have
yeah.
said that, like, there's nobody of color in it except for, you know, like, you know, a nanny or somebody who's working at the job that your character's working in. But all of the people she's really closely associated with, her girlfriends, the boyfriends, they're all white.
Yeah.
And I wonder what your reaction to that criticism has been and whether you thought about that before, you know, before or as you were writing the series.
Here's what I'll say is that I take that criticism very seriously, and while I try to avoid most of the noise of the blogosphere, that's one that I can't because it's really, really important to me to hear that and to process it and to really receive people's reactions to that because this show isn't supposed to feel exclusionary. It's supposed to feel honest, and it's supposed to feel true to many aspects of my experience, but you know, it for me to ignore that criticism and not to take it in would really go against my beliefs and my education and so many things. And I think the liberal arts student in me really wants to engage in a dialogue about it. But as I'm learning about sort of engaging with the media, I realize it's not the same as sitting in a seminar talking things through at Oberlin. Every quote is sort of used and misused and placed and misplaced, and I really wanted to make sure that I spoke sensitively to this issue. So in some way I haven't spoken about it a tremendous amount, but believe me, I've thought about it. And what I'll say is that I wrote the first season primarily by myself, and you know, I co-wrote a few episodes, but you know, I am a half Jew, half WASP, and I wrote two Jews and two WASPs. Like, I really, and something that I wanted to avoid was sort of tokenism in casting and not speaking, you know, if I had one of the four girls, for example, if she was African-American, I feel like, you know, not that the experience of an African-American girl and a white girl living in Brooklyn are drastically different, but there has to be specificity to that experience and specificity to that at this point I wasn't able to speak to. And so I thought about it. I really wrote the show from sort of a gut level place, and each character was a piece of me and or based on, you know, someone very close to me. And only later did I realize that it was four white girls, and so as much as I can say it was an accident, but I also later, as the criticism came out, I thought, I hear this and I want to respond to it, and I also, you know, the show, I don't know if this, I want, this is a hard issue to speak to because all I want to do is sound sensitive and not say anything that will horrify anyone or make them feel more isolated, but I did write something that was super specific to my experience, and I always want to avoid rendering an experience I can't speak to accurately, and I want to avoid, you know, kind of classic network tokenism in casting, because although I think that people of color are severely underrepresented on TV, I'm not sure that that's always the solution. That being said, you know, as I said in an an interview with Huffington Post. Like, now we have the opportunity to do a second season, and believe me, that will be remedied. I'm really excited to introduce new characters into the world of the show, and some of them are really great actors of color, and some of them are white actors, and we're going to continue to try to tell really honest stories, but the world of the show is definitely growing more diverse.
So your character is in relationship with a guy who, it's hard to tell if he really cares about your character or not. He wants a sex partner, that's for certain.
Yes, and he does want a sex partner, and he wants a sex partner who's flexible both time-wise, emotionally, and physically.
Yes, and he wants to enact certain sexual fantasies and have certain sexual positions that he seems to have probably gotten from porn sites, and your character goes along with it, even though your character doesn't seem to be getting any sexual pleasure out of it. It's more like an activity they can do together that makes him happy and that's okay with her. It's kind of like having a boyfriend who likes to go hiking, and it's not really your thing, but you'll go on a hike with him.
Yeah.
So do you get the sense that a lot of guys your age have learned about sex through porn sites and have these unrealistic and sometimes ludicrous ideas of what sex is like or what a girl would like?
I do get that sense. I get the sense that there's a new kind of learned behavior. I had a conversation with Frank Bruni about this for the New York Times, where he was asking me, about the porn question. And I told him that there are certain things that you'll experience when, not like I want to make it sound like I'm all over town, testing different guys, sexual prowesses, but I in my own personal limited sexual experience, I have found that there are guys doing things where you go, there's no way that is your own personal instinct. You learned that from somewhere, and it wasn't, a birds and bees conversation with your mom, and it also wasn't taught to you by a high school girl you met in Michigan. Like, that is something that you have, learned through osmosis culturally, and now A, want to try yourself, or even more insidiously, think that I will like. And I think that young people are really scared to tell each other what they actually want. It's funny, I mean, not to get too personal, but I just found a diary that I kept in college. I've been an intermittent diary keeper always, never a faithful one. And some guy had done something, it wasn't anything, too dramatic. Like, he'd just been, I think, sort of, we'd kissed in college, and he'd been sort of rough with me. And I asked him if he always acted that way. And he said, no, I don't. But with you, I do, because it's clearly what you want.
What made him say that?
Which was, to me, I was looking back at it. I think at the time, I just felt this guilt. I was like, why am I oh, my God, what kind of girl am I that I'm projecting that that's what I want? How did I, just massive guilt. And I remember at the time thinking, oh my God, if I could just replay that and act differently, then we could have had this sweet encounter and I've missed out on something great. And I realized now that that's just some way for a guy to shirk responsibility for some weird, embarrassing thing that they've done. And I mean, it's almost like your skirt was too short and you were asking for it. So that's the weirdest human interaction I have on record in my diary. But I was thinking that encounter and that interaction has informed more of my work than I ever knew when I reread it.
Do you think it's difficult, and I don't want to get too personal with you, I don't want to cross a line, so I'll ask generically, do you think it's difficult for young single women to say no to a guy who wants to try some things he's probably learned from a porn site and say, I'm not going to enjoy that, that's not going to be pleasurable, it's not even going to be comfortable?
I do. I mean, it's difficult for me to say no to my friends who want to try a restaurant that I don't think I'm going to like. So it's like, trying to say no to something that personal and specific, it's really hard. And I also think that, maybe girls will rise up against me and go, I don't know what your problem is, but I feel perfectly comfortable saying no. But, for me, I mean, I think that for young women, sex is about sex, but sex is also about wanting to be liked and wanting to be appreciated. And the fear when you say no is that someone will go, okay, well then see you later. Like that you will, lose your loving audience. So yeah, I think it is really challenging. And I think in the sexual relationship on the show between Hannah and Adam, I wanted to show that it's not a case of complete victimization. Hannah thinks about sex as a way to learn more about herself. And she kind of feels like she needs to accept whatever opportunity to learn is offered to her. And Adam is continually testing the boundaries and also using sex as a way to experience, to be close and also not to be close. And so he's not going to have the kind of sex where you move slowly and look into each other's eyes. He wants to be near another person, but in the least intimate way possible. And as the season goes on, you sort of learn more about his drives and who he is and what happens when they strip away a little bit of that role play. But it's a complicated dance.
So, of course, you know, Girls is a comedy. So even though STDs is a real anxiety-producing serious issue for the girls on the show, there's also comedic aspects of it. For example, when Hannah is told by her current boyfriend, Adam, that he doesn't have HPV, he got tested, therefore he couldn't possibly have given it to her, then she thinks, well, the only person I could have gotten it from was my old college boyfriend. So she makes an appointment to see him at a restaurant, and she assumes that he's still in love with her. But she dresses up nicely to break the news that, you know, she got this probably from him. And she thinks she's doing right by both of them in doing this. But she's in for a big surprise. So here's Hannah with her old college boyfriend at a restaurant, and he speaks first. Oh, and I should say, he is played by Andrew Rannells, who is the star of the Broadway musical The Book of Mormon, and he's really incredible.
So he's incredible, and he's a great improviser too, and this was his first day ever, besides the time that he played a headless male dancer on Sex and the City. This was his first ever on-screen performance.
Wow. Okay, here we go.
It's really great to hear from you. Really great to hear from you. I mean, I've been thinking how much I wanted to speak with you.
Well, Elijah, I'm really happy to see you too. I don't want to mislead you. Mm-hmm. I did not bring you here to retread old territory emotionally.
Okay.
I'm more open to it physically, and I brought you here to talk about something pretty specific, mm-hmm. which is a little bit touchy.
All right.
And I don't want to assume anything about you and other partners.
It's true.
It's true?
And I hate that you found out through the post collegiate rumor mill, but I'm glad that you heard, because, you know, things with Beau were moving so quickly, and I just felt like eventually we were going to either see you or
Beau?
What's his name? Yes.
And Beau is
my lover.
Who's male?
Yes.
I didn't know
that. Oh.
So
oh.
You're gay.
Oh, well, I don't say gay. I don't say straight either. I'm with a person of my own gender, which essentially means that I am, you know,
romantic. Which I love.
Well, thank you.
Which I love.
Thank you. Oh, Hannah.
Don't.
Okay.
I'm fine. What I'm having right now is an inappropriate physical reaction to my total joy for you and your self-discovery.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. And listen, I want you to know that this exploration was very much inspired by you.
And I do explore.
You do.
I mean, right now I'm seeing this guy, and sometimes I let him hit me on the side of my body, so
I mean, that's great that you're seeing someone.
That's my guest, Lena Dunham and Andrew Rannells, in a scene from the HBO series Girls.
It's probably bad to laugh at your own work, but that scene just makes me laugh. He makes me laugh so hard. All the reverse footage of me is just me giggling my head off while he improvises.
Yeah, and there's another half to that scene that comes later in the show that's as funny or funnier. I think so many young men and women find out after relationship that their former partner is now, you know, a lesbian or gay. Has that happened to you? It's really a common.
It is. It has certainly
experience.
Happened to me.
Yeah,
it has happened to me more than once, and it's funny. My mom and I keep saying it must be genetic because she's got like a couple of them in her past too, and so our hope is that what it means is that we are a comfortable resting place for a sensitive guy who's figuring things out. Our fear is that we turn men gay.
Well, your character is really being so insensitive to his discovery about his identity.
Oh my God, she's being such a brat. She says some really horrifying things. I was really hoping that my, you know, my gay male friends, of which I have many, would find it hilarious and not think that I was, you know, that I was expressing my own deep-rooted homophobia, because it was really important to me to look at the honest way that even though Hannah's an enlightened liberal girl who probably thinks about gay men as her target audience, she still is not pleased to find out that she was dating one.
So one of the things that happens to your character in Girls comes directly from your own experience. She has tattoos on her body, and the tattoos are illustrations from children's books. And
yeah.
I think that's almost, and I know that's, you have that too.
I do.
And I think it's I think it's a perfect illustration of the, a perfect metaphor for where the character is. She's trying to, like, assert her independence and adulthood through something like tattoos, but what are the tattoos pictures of? Childhood books.
Yeah. That's amazing. I've actually never thought about that, but that's an incredibly clear, nice visual for what she's experiencing.
So why did you want your tattoos, which are usually signs of, like, rebellion, to be childhood books?
Well, it's funny. I got my first tattoo when I was 17, and it was Eloise from the book Eloise on my lower back in the sort of tramp stamp place. And then and then from there on out, I just, you know, the next idea I had was a children's book idea. I've always been drawn to sort of like the softness but sophistication of children's book illustrations. And there was something about being able to sort of carry my child. Eloise was a huge symbol of comfort for me, and so there was something about being able to sort of like carry those pieces of my childhood on me always, and the idea that they would be that sort of a never forget feeling that I really liked. And so that was sort of, I think, the impetus for starting with the tattoos. And it really also was this thing which I say in the show about sort of taking ownership of your own body, like, as I think so much body modification and kind of out there style moves are, that it's sort of the desire to kind of reclaim your body and go, this is not what society thinks it is. You may see a chubby teenage girl, but I'm making the choice. I am making bold choices about how I want to look and how I want to feel.
So to sum up here, you have pictures of your favorite childhood books on your body, which every mm-hmm. sexual partner will see. And it's not exactly like the most sexually charged kind of imagery. I mean, who else is going to see those images, right?
So that's absolutely true.
So what does that mean?
Well, that's such an interesting question. You know, it's really funny. There's, firstly, it's always a topic of conversation, whether you're doing a sex scene or whether you're doing actual sex, what these things are. And I think, you know, when I started getting tattoos, it was before I had any sexual relationship to anybody. So it was really about my relationship with myself. And so I kind of like that they come from that spot, that they were never sort of sensually motivated. They were really personally motivated. And so now I think about it more like people who I'm naked near are seeing these sort of artifacts of who I once was, and maybe getting a clearer sense of who I am. There's something very vulnerable about showing your tattoos to people, even while it gives you a feeling that you're wearing a sleeve when you're naked.
Lena Dunham is the creator and star of HBO's Girls. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Gretchen Reynolds tells us why a lot of what we know about exercising, running, and stretching may be wrong. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Gretchen Reynolds, says new scientific studies are showing that a lot of what you know about exercising, running, and stretching may be wrong. Her new book is called The First 20 Minutes. Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. Reynolds writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times Well blog. She spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week.
Gretchen Reynolds, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. Let me tell you my dilemma. I was reading your book, which was convincing me that I have to exercise more, But of course, I couldn't exercise because I had to finish your book before I went to sleep, which is kind of what happens to me every night. Most people have their equivalent reason of why they can't exercise. So just to make us feel a little bit worse and to scare us a little bit more about the consequences, what happens to your muscles or your tendons if you sit still for too long?
Well, sitting is unfortunately very unhealthy, and I do it constantly, so it worries me. What science is finding is that sitting for long periods of time, when you don't stand up, don't move at all, tends to cause changes physiologically within your muscles that cause a whole host of changes, the most dire being that you stop breaking up fat in your bloodstream. You start getting accumulations of fat. And what that causes is you get accumulations of fat then in your liver, your heart, your brain. And you just get sleepy, you gain weight, you basically are much less healthy than if you're moving.
And what happens to your muscles and your spine?
Terrible things. Your muscles become much more slack. They're much less able then to respond when you do stand up. And your spine, you get back pain. You have all sorts of unhealthy changes that make it that much harder then to move later. So the big, big problem with sitting a lot is it makes it harder then to move later, which is what you need to be doing.
Right. So you get into this vicious cycle. So give us some of your suggestions for people who, because of their work, are pretty chair-bound a good deal of the day. And, you know, it's hard for them to get up and exercise. And maybe the workplace doesn't even have a good option for you to get up and move around.
Well, the very, very best thing is to simply stand up. And that sounds so simple, but it actually has profound consequences. If you can stand up every 20 minutes, even if you do nothing else, even if you don't move to the window, you change how your body responds physiologically. You start using the big muscles in your legs because you have to hold you upright. They start contracting. That actually releases enzymes that break up the fat in your bloodstream. It improves your blood flow. It lessens the amount of fat that you'll wind up having in your heart. It decreases your chances of getting diabetes. It decreases your chance of getting heart disease. And all it requires is standing up.
For how long?
2 minutes. There actually was a very interesting study that came out that showed 2 minutes of standing up every 20 minutes reduced people's chances of getting diabetes by a pretty large amount. If you can also walk around your office, walk to the window, walk to the next cubicle, you get even more benefits. You'll lose weight. You will improve your heart, your lessen your risk of heart disease, and you will improve your brain. But if you can do nothing else, stand up.
So in your book, you describe yourself as like taking phone calls while standing up, conducting interviews while standing up.
I do all of that. I actually have started because, as I also say in the book, one of the very worst things for your fitness is to write about fitness. I sit all day long. So I started in self-defense standing up when I did phone calls, when I did interviews. I bought a music stand, which costs next to nothing. You can put papers on it and read standing up. I make notes to myself standing up. I try and walk down the hall at least once an hour. That's enough to break up the physiological changes that sitting otherwise causes.
Well, it's reassuring to hear that you could just do like a couple of minutes of walking or standing and it actually amounts to something if you do it every 20 minutes or so.
Well, the best part of all, at least for me, because I am honestly very shallow, is that standing up appears to increase the number of calories that you burn. So if you do nothing else during the day, if you stand up regularly, you will almost certainly burn more calories and be at least a little less likely to gain weight.
So the science is really changing and contradicting a lot of previous wisdom about what we should do if we want to be physically fit. So let's start with how science is changing about stretching. A lot of people stretch, for instance, before they run or before they exercise. And some researchers are saying maybe not such a good idea.
Almost all the research is, in fact, suggesting that stretching before a workout, which all of us were taught to do in our own phys ed classes is probably counterproductive. It actually seems to cause the brain to think that you are about to tear those muscles. When you stretch and hold that pose, you lean over and touch your toes and hold that position for 30 seconds, the brain thinks you are about to damage yourself. And it sends out nerve impulses that actually tend to tighten the muscles, that the brain is trying to keep you from overstretching that muscle, but the result is you're less ready for activity, not more ready for activity. So it seems quite clear that stretching before you exercise is not actually a good idea.
Do you warm up before you run? And if so, what do you do?
I jog for a short period of time before I start to run. And the science suggests that a very easy warm-up may be all that most of us need. What you want to do when you warm up is to literally warm up the tissues. You want to get the muscles, the tendons, all of the parts of your body warm, raise the internal temperature. And the best way to do that is to use those tissues. That means if you're going to go for a run, start out by jogging. If you're going to be playing tennis, start out with a little bit of jogging and then make sure you do something that moves your shoulders. There is a new theory about warming up that says people should do dynamic stretching, which is quite different than the old-fashioned stretching that most of us did.
What is it?
Dynamic stretching is essentially movement. It's not even really stretching at all. It means if you are going to be using a joint, warm up by using it. If you're going to be playing golf, do some practice swings. Move the joint. Do not stretch it and hold it. If you're going to be hitting a tennis ball, do jumping jacks so that your arms are up over your head. Get the tissues warmed up and get them in motion. Then you'll be ready to safely do much harder actions, like actually hitting a tennis ball or hitting a golf ball or running.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gretchen Reynolds, and she writes the Phys Ed column for the Well blog on the New York Times Online. She's the author of the new book, The First 20 Minutes, that's about the science of exercise. So you're a runner, and you've been a runner for decades.
Mm-hmm.
What does science say now about the benefits and the risks of running?
Well, the benefits are unequivocal. Running is a wonderful way to reduce your risk of heart disease, reduce your risk of diabetes. If you run regularly, it does maintain your weight. It also has a very strong impact on the brain, which may be the single most important reason that I run. There's very good science that running for even half an hour or so doubles the number of brain cells in portions of your brain related to memory. Running is wonderful for the health of your body. It also leads almost inexorably to injury. The injury rate among runners is extremely high. By some estimates, it's 75% of runners will get injured almost every year. So running can be very hard on the body at the same time that it's very good for the body.
What about walking? I mean, there doesn't seem to be much of a downside to walking. What are the benefits of it?
Oh, walking is, I would say without a doubt, the single best exercise that exists. It is very low impact. Certainly, you can hurt yourself if you want to. You can trip over something.
There's
overdo
always
it.
Something to trip on.
You can run into things, which I've done before.
Absolutely.
I actually used to read and walk when I was in college. I would try and read my textbooks while walking, and I did a few times run into stop signs. So that's one way to injure yourself. Otherwise, walking appears to be what the human body is built for. There have been some very good studies showing that the most efficient stride for the human body is a walk, not a run. That means we use less oxygen, we use less energy when we walk than when we run. We are built for that movement. It does definitely stimulate all of the health benefits that you want from exercise. walking for 30 minutes or even 20 minutes, even 15 minutes, will reduce your risk for heart disease and for diabetes. It will change your brain, and it will prolong your life. There was a really interesting study out of England showing that walking for 30 minutes at least 4 or 5 times a week increased people's lifespans by 20%. If you tripled that amount of exercise, if you ran for 90 minutes 4 or 5 times a week, you prolonged your lifespan a little bit more, but only by 4%. So you get most of the benefits from just going for a walk.
Let's talk about hydrating in general. You know, a lot of people think, and we've been told, you should drink like 8 glasses of liquids a day. You know, water's fine. The impression I get from your book is that that's being disproven.
Yes, yet again, when you actually put it to the test, that very entrenched myth turns out to not be true. We don't need 8 glasses of water a day. The body's thirst mechanism is extremely, exquisitely attuned to telling us how much fluid we need. Most of us have been taught, and I've run several marathons now. The last time I ran a marathon, which was 15 years ago now, I was told, drink as much as you possibly can before the race, during the race, after the race, constantly. Stop at every water stop. Do not let yourself get thirsty. Well, the result of that is that some runners developed what is called water intoxication. They actually had so much water in their bodies that it became an unhealthy and even critically dangerous condition. What we now know, and what seems clear from the science, is that if you drink to thirst, if you listen to the little voice in your head that says you need water, you will drink as much as you need. You don't need to stay ahead of your thirst. Drink what you want, and you will almost certainly be fine.
So you said if you're exercising for more than an hour, you do need to replenish on the sugars. And the good news is that chocolate milk is apparently a nice balanced drink for that, assuming you're not lactose intolerant.
Yeah, chocolate milk, the science of chocolate milk is one of my favorite discoveries. Chocolate milk is actually an almost ideal recovery beverage. And that means for in the period after you exercise, not during exercise. That much protein and milk would probably cause gastrointestinal distress during exercise. But if you've worked out, again, for at least an hour, so you have burned a certain number of calories, then you do need to replenish the fuel you've lost. You also need to give your body some protein to help to rebuild the muscles. Chocolate milk seems to have an ideal ratio of carbohydrates, the sugar, to protein, and it tastes wonderful. So in the hour after you exercise, have some chocolate milk. You will probably recover better. If you've gone for a 30-minute walk, I'm sorry, chocolate milk is probably not your exercise drink of choice. If you want to lose weight, just remember calories in, calories out. Whether you've worked out or not, you have to be realistic about how many calories you just burned. If you walked for 30 minutes, you didn't burn enough calories to have chocolate milk.
Are there any exercises that you've stopped doing because you've learned through your research that they're more harmful than helpful?
Not really. What I have started doing are exercises that I actually thought were unhealthy and turned out not to be. I do squats, which look very ungainly, but I've had several scientists tell me that if they can only do one exercise on any given day, they will do squats, because squats, they burn calories, they build the muscles in your legs and your bottom, they make you stronger. It's also the squat is essentially an exercise that can guarantee that you will be independent all through your lifespan. Because one of the things that happens as people get older is you lose muscle mass, You lose strength and you become unable to get up out of your chair. If you're doing squats, you will always be able to stand up. So I now do 20 squats at least a few times a week. I don't use weights. You don't have to hold a dumbbell. Just squat up, squat down, stand up, and do it again.
So when you say squats, you mean like deep knee bends? Same.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Uh-huh. And if that's hard.
I had heard those are really bad for your knees, right? Didn't they say
that? They're not.
They're not.
In fact, it appears pretty clearly that if you do it correctly, it's good for your knees because it builds the muscles and the tendons all around your knee. It makes it more stable. So in fact, doing squats appears to be a very good thing for your knees. Do it carefully. If it hurts, don't go all the way down until your thighs are parallel to the ground. Maybe keep your thighs at a 60-degree angle to the ground. But it should, for someone who has healthy knees, it should make your knees stronger. You can also, if you find a regular squat really difficult, do what are called wall squats, meaning you lean against the wall and go up and down. Then when that's easy, move away from the wall, do 20. It really has made a big difference, I think, in my leg strength.
Well, Gretchen Reynolds, I'm going to end this interview so I can take a walk.
Please do.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Gretchen Reynolds speaking with Terry Gross. Reynolds' book about the new science of fitness and exercise is called The First 20 Minutes. You can read a chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you'll also find longer versions of all the interviews heard on Fresh Air Weekend.
I'm walking.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. This is Fresh Air Weekend.